This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll catch up with our own co-host, Dalia Hashad. We'll also have some updates on the illegal wars in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Sadly, it's been a very violent year in Iraq and Afghanistan, much of it because of the U.S.
We'll hear excerpts from two important talks by Len Weinglass and Jane Franklin, our way of marking the 49th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution.
That's a very, very positive thing to hear about. 49 years, 90 miles off the coast of Florida, a socialist revolution.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dalia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
This is our first show for the new year 2008, and we have back with us, although she's partially AWOL, Dalia Hashad, speaking to us from California. And the reason she's in California is, Dalia, tell everybody.
Well, I had a little girl. I had a baby back in September. That's why I've been gone from the show, listening still, streaming online, but not with you guys in studio.
And what's your daughter's name?
Her name is Iman. And which means faith. So I guess it's a fitting sentiment for the new year, having a little faith that hopefully things are going to turn around. And if there's one thing to make you optimistic about the future, it's having a baby. I don't think I felt this optimistic since before September 2001.
I noticed that, Dalia, because we all got a note from you saying you would join us on the phone and you were feeling better about the new year. And I actually had trouble figuring it out exactly. But now you're explaining that a new baby makes you think better. Than yeah. You have to have some hope when you're bringing new life into the world, right?
You know, you do. And it's funny because I'll be playing with her on the floor, and I'm listening to the news in the background. Sometimes I'll catch myself saying things to her like, well, I hope it's a very different world for you when you grow up. It's really scary to think about how our world is changing. And what our country's role in that is, to look at a little one and to think you're releasing her out into this world.
It is difficult. I agree with that.
I definitely have great appreciation for the parents of people in Guantanamo, because I think various organizations, CCR included, have been making a concerted effort to get their voices out to the world about what it's like to have a loved one, to have a child in Guantanamo. You think about someone that you've cared for and you nurture every day and you brought into this world, and having them disappear like that is just horrifying.
Yeah, a person just died there a couple days ago. Michael, give us the update on what's happening in Guantanamo.
Well, you know, next week we're going to do much of a show on all of the different developments in Guantanamo, from Supreme Court to people down there to torture to releases to suicides, etc. This week, we're just going to mention one event, which really corresponds to the center's involvement in Guantanamo and my own, which is the release finally out of prison of David Hicks. People may remember David Hicks was from Australia. He was a sort of what they call a roustabout in Australia, kangaroo skinner and other kinds of things, picked up in Afghanistan and taken to Guantanamo, and was in the first plane load to Guantanamo, which the anniversary is coming up, the sixth anniversary, January 11th. 2002 was the official day that people arrived in Guantanamo. David Hicks was on the first plane. As I said, he was a young Australian. And he was finally released after 2,211 days in custody. And it came about, of course, in a way that's interesting. He is the only person who has ever, quote, and I use quotes, convicted by what's called a military commission at Guantanamo. And what really happened was he served in Guantanamo for 5 years without any kind of trial or hearing. They charged him before a military commission. He then, on a deal that was made apparently with the former Prime Minister of Australia, got a sentence of 9 months in prison after pleading guilty. So he was never really tried. He always said he wanted to be tried before a real court. They never gave him that opportunity. He pled guilty at Guantanamo to 9 months. He served that 9 months in Australia and was just released in Australia after, as I said, a total of 2,211 days in prison, essentially a slap on the wrist, the 9 months.
This guy never really had a chance. I mean, this was the center's first client at Guantanamo. Was that right?
Right, that's right. I saw his name in the paper, and I called lawyers in Australia, and eventually it was the center's first case, and actually the first case of all the Guantanamo cases was David Hicks.
And I think it's really emblematic of how people have been treated and ended up in Guantanamo, because he was picked up in late 2001, which is about 6 years ago, by the Northern Alliance and sold to the U.S. military for $1,000. He wasn't picked up, you know, on the battlefield and ended up in Guantanamo the next day. He was picked up by the Northern Alliance and sold. When he was in U.S. custody in Afghanistan, he was interviewed by Australian intelligence, and he reported being beaten, he reported being tortured, and he pleaded for legal assistance. He said he needed a lawyer, and those pleas went ignored. He did not get the legal assistance he needed, and as Michael just said, he was shipped off to Guantanamo that first month of 2002.
Right. In fact, we began representing him, not him really, although him through his parents, because as you said, he was not allowed legal assistance. We filed a case, what's the habeas corpus petition, the right to go to court and challenge why he was being detained. We filed that on behalf of his father, and we weren't even allowed to communicate with David Hicks, that we were his lawyers. We were simply representing his father as next friend of his son. And really, until we really won the cases much later on, we never got access to David Hicks.
Well, what did he say, Dahlia? You've got his statement when he got out of prison.
Yeah, he's been in, as Michael said, he's been in the Italia prison in the southern part of Australia. He's finally being released. It's been 6 years of detention, often in solitary confinement. He has reportedly very significant mental health problems and has suffered a significant mental health decline. Some people were disappointed that it wasn't he who read the statement and came out to meet the press, but it was his lawyer. And his lawyer read the statement from David Hicks, which read as follows. Thank you for coming out on a Saturday and during the holiday period. I know you all hoped I might appear and answer some questions. I had hoped to be able to speak to the media, but I'm just not strong enough at the moment. It's as simple as that. I'm sorry for that. As part of my conditions of release from Guantanamo Bay, I agreed not to speak to the media on a range of issues before March 30th, 2008. It is my intention to honor this agreement, as I don't want to do anything that might result in my return there. So for now, I will limit what I have to say. I will say more at a later time. I would ask the media and the public to understand and respect this. I do, however, want to take this opportunity to say some overdue thank yous. First and foremost, I would like to recognize the huge debt of gratitude that I owe the Australian public for getting me home. I will not forget or let you down. Next, I would like to thank my family and friends who have been so supportive of me. Words cannot adequately express the level of my feelings for them. I love them very much. Also, my team of lawyers, Major Dan Morey, Josh Dreitel, Michael Griffin, Steve Kenny, and David McLeod, as well as their legal teams in Adelaide, Sydney, Washington, and London. Much of their work was carried out pro bono, and they know I owe my freedom to their efforts. I also thank the legal professions within Australia, including the Law Council of Australia and the state law societies and those abroad who strove to uphold the ideal of a free trial for an Australian citizen. Many, many thanks go to the Fair Go for David campaigners and organizations such as Amnesty International, Get Up, the International Committee of the Red Cross, Dick Smith, church groups including the Catholic Church, and various anti-torture and human rights groups. The Red Cross played an important role by trying to improve conditions and treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. I thank them from the bottom of my heart for their efforts. A huge thank you also to the members of the media who wrote about and increased public awareness of my detention and treatment over the years. Without you, the court of public opinion would not have been as informed or influential. There are many other groups, both large and small, and individuals involved in the campaign for my return to Australia, and to them I offer my heartfelt thanks. This list is in no particular order, and to anyone I haven't mentioned, I'm very sorry. I hope to thank all of you personally at a later date. Right now, I'm looking forward to some quiet time with my wonderful dad, my family, and friends. I ask that you respect my privacy as I will need time to readjust to society and to obtain medical care for the consequences of 5.5 years at Guantanamo Bay. I have been told that my readjustment will be a slow process and should involve gentle transition away from the media spotlight. Thank you for respecting my privacy and allowing me some breathing room to get on with my life. And that was a statement from David Hicks, read by his lawyer upon the release of David Hicks, Southern Australia.
Well, thank you, Dahlia. And next week, as we have told you all, we'll be bringing you more updates on Guantanamo and what is the fate of the 300 people who still remain there.
Okay, I'll talk to you guys soon.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Michael, as we gear up for an exciting new year for civil liberties, we have an event happening later this week.
Yes, on January 11th, which will be the 6th anniversary of the Guantanamo detentions. Again, that's when David Hicks first went there. There's been a call for an International Day of Action to shut down Guantanamo. The main activities will be taking place in Washington, where there'll be a demonstration at the National Mall, an orange jumpsuit procession to the Supreme Court, and various other activities in Washington on January 11th. There will also be other solidarity actions around the world, Paris, Chicago, possibly New York as well. You can find out more about it, and it's an important demonstration, an important effort to shut down Guantanamo. You can find out more at witnesstorture.org. That's www.witnesstorture.org. Go to that website, look up what's happening, get yourself to Washington if you can, or if there's a demonstration in New York, get there, or in other cities that hear this programming, please. It's an effort that's important. There'll be a civil disobedience part of the effort, but there'll also be a permitted demonstration as well, so you can participate in many different ways in this effort to close Guantanamo on the 6th anniversary. You know, as we welcome the new year, there's been a lot of talk in the papers about improvements in Iraq and all this kind of stuff, but there's some figures here that belie the claims about Iraq and Afghanistan. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about that, Heidi?
In 2007 in Afghanistan, we actually saw record violence and the killing of over 6,500 people. Now, that included 110 U.S. troops, the highest level we've ever seen in Afghanistan, and about 4,500 militants. This is according to an AP count.
They call militants, right?
Right. I'm quoting from their report. Britain lost 41 soldiers, Canada lost 100, and other nations totaled together lost about 40. This count is not definitive. It's based on figures from Western and Afghan officials. But I think that we need to take stock now and then on the human casualties from this illegal invasion that was based on a foundation of lies by the U.S. government. It's also interesting to note that the sort of campaign against poppies by our government in Afghanistan has failed. And this year, Afghanistan produced 93% of the world's opium. So that just like our so-called war on terror and our so-called war on drugs, these campaigns that are built on lies and artifice and public relations have been an abysmal failure.
Yeah, the lie is simply this. Afghanistan had nothing to do with 9/11. Most of the people involved with 9/11 were from Saudi Arabia, yet Afghanistan bore the brunt of the air attacks right after and the slaughter that's continued now for 6 years.
You know, there's an interesting piece I read about that that essentially said U.S. or imperialism, et cetera, has to show that it can kill and use its military as a way of showing itself strong. And Afghanistan was the first one, and Iraq was the second one. Many people I talk to basically believe the Afghanistan war has lost already. There's large swaths of Afghanistan, particularly the mountainous part, in which the U.S. has no control. And I recently read somewhere the U.S. is willing to start negotiating again with the Taliban. Whether that's true or not, I don't know.
But Michael, wasn't it true that initially they started the war in Afghanistan because they wanted to put an oil pipeline through there?
Well, I don't know if that's why they started the war. They certainly, while the Taliban were there, we were negotiating at various times, various oil companies, with the Taliban to try and get the oil pipeline into there. I don't know what's happened since or whether they built the pipeline, but certainly Afghanistan, I mean, their ostensible reason was to, you know, get rid of Osama bin Laden and the so-called training camps, but in fact it was a generalized war against the Taliban and against Afghanistan.
And speaking of the Taliban, another record was set in 2007. Taliban suicide bomber set off a record number of attacks, over 140.
In Afghanistan?
Yeah.
Because, you know, someone I understood was they're planning to refilm The Wizard of Oz. And remember that scene with the poppies in
yes.
it? They're probably going to go to Afghanistan to do that.
Heidi, update us on Iraq as well.
Well, continuing with our very sad figures, the second half of 2007 saw some violence dropped in Iraq. But the year was still the deadliest for the U.S. military since the 2000 invasion, with almost 900 troops killed. 899 individuals were killed there.
Of course, in Iraq, they're now claiming that the last month was the least deadly for U.S. soldiers, which in fact may be the case, although I'm not sure what it was for Iraqi civilians. And they claim it was because of the so-called surge, or what I call an escalation of the war. When you look at the actual facts on the ground, I think some of the key people, I think Sadr's group and some others, have simply declared a ceasefire for 6 months, which is what caused a lot of the lessening, or some of the lessening.
A report that I just read said that this total for 2007 can actually rise, because sometimes there's a lag in when military reports of casualties occur. But the 899 deaths in 2007 actually surpassed the previously highest total death toll in 2004, when 850 U.S. soldiers were killed. I don't see how this is an improvement.
Right, I don't either. And in fact, when you looked at the paper today, you realize that the violence going backwards may pale, unfortunately, with the violence going forward. In Afghanistan, in Iraq, and then, of course, you saw what happened in Kenya with people being burned in a church. You see what's happening in Pakistan after the assassination of Bhutto. You see what's happening in Nigeria. You see what's happening in Sudan. So we're talking about a violent last year and what looks to be like a very violent future.
And the amount of casualties that are reported are probably way lower than what actually exists. The British medical journal Lancet estimates how many hundreds of thousands, maybe over a million people that were killed in Iraq since it started.
I think it's a million, Michael. I think that's
million.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're talking about whatever we do when we leave this radio show or go out and have our coffee or something, a lot of people are being killed, and a lot of them are being killed because of the country we're living in.
And to make the point, just like in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq was totally illegal. Iraq had nothing to do with the reasons why the Bush administration said they needed to go to war against Iraq.
Yeah. Okay, but in news that might be a little less depressing and give people a little bit of heart, we, of course, on January 1st of 2008, was the 49th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution. An amazing feat, particularly because the leader of that revolution, Fidel Castro, is still alive despite U.S. efforts both to overthrow the revolution from the Bay of Pigs on, continuing today with the embargo and other acts of violence, as well as attempts to assassinate Fidel. So we're talking about a bright spot in the quest for a more egalitarian future.
I can remember what happened on that day because I read the papers and saw the news.
What day?
And, the U.S. dictator, January 1st, 1959. I was 17 years old. Batista, the U.S. dictator, got on a plane and flew to where? Miami Beach. With his group, the revolutionaries marched and rode horseback in from the countryside into Havana. They got there several days later, and that began what great experiment that there is another way possible here in our hemisphere. The first thing that the revolutionaries did was they declared a land reform. They said, but we're not going to just take the land from the United States owned most of the land. And they said, we're going to pay you for it, but we're going to pay you according to how much you've said the land is worth when you pay taxes to us. The United States didn't go for that deal. The Cubans took the land anyway. And the United States then retaliated, and they called an embargo against Cuba. Cuba responded to that by nationalizing the oil company and the telephone company and the tobacco fields and the rice fields and the sugar fields. And that became what was called the Cuban Socialist Revolution. And we have it now going into the 50th year.
And it's a great model.
It's a great model, but, you know, to those of our audience who have ever been to Cuba and seen it, you can understand how difficult and harsh the embargo is. This is not just about dealing with the United States directly. This is about if you buy, for example, an X-ray machine from England and any part in that X-ray machine is made by a U.S. company, you can't buy the machine. The U.S. government has gotten the embargo tighter and tighter and tighter, and under the Bush administration, it's tightest. So that banks all around the world for periods of time were intimidated, or still are, about exchanging Cuban money, giving credits, all kinds of things. And that effect in Cuba, you can look at many different instances of it. Of course, right after the revolution, they were using all of their buses and all of their materials were from the United States, and they couldn't get spare parts. So that their transportation system, their factory system just went down. Then they all of a sudden they start getting help from the Soviet Union, and they're getting that help through the 80s. And then the Soviet Union changes, something that, you know, none of us in life would have ever thought about growing up, changes, and all of a sudden they have no spare parts for anything they have from the Soviet Union. So, for example, they were using buses from Hungary, and now they can't get spare parts for the buses from Hungary. So they've had two essential real blows if you look at how that government and how that society is to live, and therefore it's not a rich society, it never will be, but it is one that at least sought equality, egalitarianism, and brought its people two or three essentials, two being health care for everybody, as well as education.
And housing as well.
And housing as well, although housing now is short because of the economics of the situation.
And they realized that they couldn't establish a truly egalitarian, well-to-do society on one island alone, that the revolution had to be internationalized. And it was the heroic sacrifice of the Cuban people. Che Guevara is the main example, but the Cuban people generally who went around the world to help, who sent doctors around the world, who sent troops to the southern cone of Africa.
Well, today there's 25,000 Cuban doctors in Venezuela, and they just finished helping Venezuela build their first big children's pediatric hospital, a huge one in Caracas. And of course, in exchange, Cuba is able to get oil from Venezuela on a much more equal level than they ever would have, and that's going to allow the revolution to make some gains.
And what if the troops they sent to Angola that protected the South Africans and allowed the apartheid regime in South Africa to be overthrown?
They have a wonderful medical school that's free for people from all around the world. The only commitment the students have to make is that when they go back to their countries, they have to agree to be working for their communities, serving the people that most need medical care. And Fidel also offered to send doctors. Was it after the Katrina?
Yeah, sure.
But of course, our government.
He also offered to send election observers to the United States after Bush stole the election in Florida in the year 2000. But anyway,
none of this is to downplay issues that are problems in Cuba.
Right.
I mean, they're still very poor. The embargo still takes a very heavy effect. They unfortunately have a two-currency system, one for the workers and one for tourists, that causes a fair amount of resentment. But one thing they're doing now, which is interesting, they're going through a process to get incredible feedback, et cetera, from all kinds of groups and people in Cuba. It's a self-criticism sort of thing where you're anonymously meeting in groups, allowed to say whatever you want. They're compiling all these things on what the main issues people like, what they don't like. And my imagining is there's going to be, to the extent they can make changes under their economic situation, there will be changes for the better. They're going through some kind of revaluation. But it certainly has worked for many, many people in Cuba. You realize 1 million people left Cuba. There's 11 million now. There were 6 at the time of the revolution. 1 million left, and the high majority were the owners, the business people, the landowners, et cetera. And what this revolution really did was take people who were whatever you want to call the lower class, the underclass, the poor, and bring them up with a dignity they would have never had under a capitalist system.
And today we're going to bring some excerpts from two of the really authorities on Cuba, Jane Franklin, Len Wineglass.
Yeah, Jane Franklin wrote the book on U.S.-Cuban relations, and Len Wineglass is the noted U.S. constitutional attorney who the Cubans asked to help represent the Cuban Five. These speeches were given 2 months ago at the Brecht Forum. I also spoke on who killed Che, and then Jane Franklin spoke kind of an overall picture of the United States war on Cuba that goes all the way back, and Len Wineglass brought it up to date with the United States framing up and imprisoning the Cuban Five. So we have a special treat on the anniversary of the 49th year of the Cuban Revolution. We've got Jane Franklin and Len Wineglass speaking on Cuba.
Let's have a listen.
It's a great pleasure to be here tonight. I always say about Cuba that U.S. policy toward Cuba is amazingly consistent and consistently amazing. And we can't possibly know about those relations unless we know about the roots. But there's not time to dig out all those roots tonight. So I'll just go down the taproot past 1959, the birth of the Cuban Revolution on January 1st, past 1776, the beginning of the revolution here in this country against the British Empire, back to the time when the 13 colonies and Cuba, the colony of Spain, were all subjugated to colonialism and slavery, and even past that, of course, to when the hemisphere was populated by the native peoples, many of whom were eliminated by the European conquest. No sooner had the United States achieved independence than Washington began its march toward empire, and I do want to read one part of that period to you. In 1809, former President Thomas Jefferson wrote to President James Madison, "With Cuba and Canada," he says, "we should have such an empire for liberty as she has never surveyed since the creation." Then a few years later, in 1823, having acquired East and West Florida from Spain a few years earlier, the United States has expanded to within 90 miles of Cuba. Secretary of State John Quincy Adams then made the quintessential statement about U.S. policy toward Cuba. "There are laws of political as well as of physical gravitation, and if an apple, severed by the tempest from its native tree, cannot choose but fall to the ground, Cuba, forcibly disjoined from its own unnatural connection with Spain, and incapable of self-support, can gravitate only towards the North American Union." The Cubans call this la fruta madura, meaning that the United States would seize that fruit as soon as it considered it ripe, which it did in 1898 when U.S. troops went in to Cuba as part of the war against Spain. Well, the Cuban rebels had virtually defeated Spain at that point, and so they regard this as the U.S. intervention in their second war of independence that snatched independence out of their arms. The United States, of course, regards it as the Spanish-American War because they got more than Cuba out of it. They got two ports in the Pacific area and two ports in the Atlantic area, Philippines, Guam, Puerto Rico, and Cuba. In order to get the U.S. troops out of Cuba, the Cuban government, which had been set up by the United States, agreed to put into its constitution the Platt Amendment, which was written in Washington, of course, and was already U.S. law, like the Helms-Burton bill is now U.S. law here. The Platt Amendment was also U.S. law, but because the U.S. troops were in Cuba at the time, it also became Cuban law by force, and it gave Washington virtual control of the country, including the right to militarily intervene at any time in U.S. interest, not in Cuban interest, and including the right to occupy the place that is now Guantanamo, at Guantanamo Naval Base, the prison there now.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
que muy sentida y muy guajira alegre cantó. Me voy al transbordador, bam, bam, a descargar la carreta. Me voy al transbordador, bam, bam, a descargar la carreta, bam, bam, para cumplir con la meta, bam, bam, de mi pequeña labor.
A caballo vamos pa'l monte, a caballo vamos pa'l monte, a caballo vamos pa'l monte, a caballo vamos pa'l monte.
If you're just joining us, we're listening to Jane Franklin speaking at the Brecht Forum.
Around 1940, there was a constitution that was forced by Cuban resistance. There was always Cuban resistance. The Cuban Revolution was still a distance away, but there was a resistance movement that caused a new constitution to be written to replace the old one that the United States had written. And there were elections every 4 years. In 1952, General Batista was running for president, and he decided that he couldn't win. He was going to come in number three. So he staged a coup, suspended the Constitution, and canceled the upcoming election. And another person running in that election was a young lawyer named Fidel Castro. So he never got a chance to figure out whether he could win in something called a free election. Batista established a brutal dictatorship known worldwide for brutality. Fidel Castro, Raul Castro, and other Cuban revolutionaries went underground, attacked the Moncada, as Michael Smith has mentioned. Most of them were killed. The ones who weren't were imprisoned. They were released in 1955 because of public pressure. And Fidel and Raul and others went to Mexico, where, as Michael has explained, eventually Che Guevara linked up with them, having witnessed what the CIA had been able to do in Guatemala with the elected government of Arbenz. So in 1959, January 1st, the Cuban Revolution triumphed. After 467 years, Cuba was finally not a colony. And imagine how the revolutionaries felt at that moment. Independence was theirs. But foreigners owned 75% of the arable land, 90% of services like water and electricity, 40% of the sugar industry. Agrarian reform was absolutely necessary in order to have a revolution, a change. And attacking corporations in Cuba by taking some of their property, not all of their property, but just taking some of it, like as Michael said, at United Fruit in Guatemala. Well, in Cuba, they took a small percentage of United Fruit's land. But United Fruit was connected intimately with the White House, the Secretary of State, the head of the CIA, the UN ambassador, were all part of its corporate structure. So all that the CIA and the State Department had to do was walk into President Eisenhower's office and talk about an invasion, and they started planning an invasion of Cuba. Meantime, let's go a little bit astray here to Posada, Luis Posada. He wasn't yet quite a terrorist. While Fidel Castro and Raul Castro, Che Guevara, and other revolutionaries were risking their lives to overthrow a dictatorship, a brutal dictatorship, Luis Posada was the manager of Firestone Tire and Rubber Company in Havana. He was already giving information to the police, the Batista police, and to the FBI. He fled Cuba in 1960 and joined the trainees of the Central Intelligence Agency, which was training thousands of Cubans like him. The state of siege had begun. And I wanted to point out something very interesting here about the state of siege that has continued for all these almost 49 years. In 1961, there was a travel ban. That's when it began. That was an overt operation. It was part of a covert operation that the American people had no idea about, the plan to invade Cuba in April. The travel ban came in February. We didn't realize that the travel ban had something to do with not wanting American citizens in Havana when they started bombing Havana in April. In 1962, the trade embargo or blockade began, and we didn't know that that was part of Operation Mongoose, a second plan to invade Cuba in October 1962, which of course led directly to the missile crisis. So when you hear these surface operations, when we hear what's going on the surface with relations with Cuba, that's one channel. Underneath is always this current of secret operations that are taking place that we don't know about, and that continues right to this very day. I want to close by noting the continuity of all of this. The Platt Amendment in 1901 colonized Cuba. It was Cuban law by force of U.S. armed forces being inside Cuba. The Torricelli Act of 1992, the Helms-Burton Act of 1996, the Commission for Assistance to a Free Cuba report of 2004, the second report from that commission in 2006, all of those are U.S. policy, but they can't be Cuban policy because they don't have the army there. They are dying, not literally. They want very much to have their army there. That's the goal. They want to recolonize Cuba. But so far, Cuba has managed to keep them at bay, to keep them in Washington with their ideas, just like President Bush dealt yesterday with the same old story all over again. But there's a problem here. And that is in the 2006 report, on page 14, very short sentence, says, this is a declassified document, and it's huge, that report. It details how to run Cuba education system. They're going to teach the Cubans how to have an education system. The pharmaceutical industry, they're going to teach Cuba how to have a pharmaceutical industry, right? Medical care, they're going to provide medical care. Everything is there in that huge report. But this one sentence says, all that's declassified. But there's a classified annex. And we don't know what's in that classified annex. Now, this report mentions Venezuela quite a few times. They've added Venezuela to the mix now. And we can tell from what's going on in Venezuela and what's going on in Bolivia, we can see the tracks of the secret annex when we look. And we have to be aware, always, that underneath whatever they're saying is this current of something that we don't know about. Bush yesterday, just 6 days before the UN General Assembly is to vote on Cuba's resolution to end the blockade, Bush asked international governments to contribute to an international fund for rebuilding the infrastructure of Cuba when they managed to have a transition government after Fidel and Raul and those revolutionaries are out of the picture. Now, when he's talking about rebuilding infrastructure, how many people around the world were thinking Katrina, New Orleans? Maybe some infrastructure needs to be rebuilt? And then he said, the tropical paradise has turned into a tropical gulag. And we're thinking, gulag? Yes, there's a gulag in Cuba. It's at Guantanamo. And everybody knows that's there. I mean, this is very foolish of him to bring up gulag. Meanwhile, the Cuban people, led by heroes like Fidel Castro and Raul Castro, continue to answer Che's call by creating a bastion of resistance to U.S. imperialism, despite all obstacles. And thank you very much.
That was Jane Franklin speaking at the Brecht Forum.
Thank you, Jane Franklin. And our final speaker is Len Weinglass.
As Jane has pointed out, there has been a 40-year period of intermittent, what I call cross-border, low-intensity warfare from these shores, mainly Florida, directed against a neighbor, Cuba, with the hopes of bringing down that government. These activities, by legal definition, classically fit the term of terrorism. The Cuban Air Force has never been attacked, nor has the Cuban Navy, nor has the Cuban Army. These attacks are directed at civilian targets, which is the classical definition of terror. You intimidate a civilian population in order to compel it to comply with what you want to happen in that country. That's what terrorism is about, no matter what the source is of the terrorism. That's the ultimate aim, to intimidate people to compel a change. So that's been going on for 40 years, sometimes more aggressively, particularly at the beginning, and then sometimes less aggressively, but ongoing. But in 1990, with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the East European economies, the people in Miami saw an opportunity to bring Cuba finally to its knees because of its loss of sponsors. And so they began a campaign after they realized that Cuba decided the only salvation for its economic well-being was the building of a tourism industry, something that Cuba had refused to do up to that point and reluctantly did only because of its desperate need for hard currency. And so Cuba reached out to Italian groups and Spanish groups and French and Canadian to come and invest in Cuba and build hotels for tourism. And they did. And the Cubans began a campaign to bring people from South America, Canada, and Europe to come to Cuba for vacations and to enjoy the beaches of Cuba. I don't know how many of you are aware of this, but Cuba, by mileage, has more beachfront land than all the other countries of the Caribbean combined, including Puerto Rico. And so they were exploiting that natural resource and asset that they have. But there is one thing that tourists require, and that is a peaceful and safe stay. Knowing that, the groups in Miami, which have been opposed to the Castro government, convened a press conference in Miami. And it's only in Miami that you could do this. And they publicly announced that they were initiating a campaign to bring down the tourism industry in Cuba. And that henceforth, all of Cuba will be considered a free fire zone, borrowing a term from the U.S. military in Vietnam, which meant anything that moves within the zone is a legitimate target. So all of the potential tourists were advised, if you come to Cuba to enjoy a quiet vacation with your family, you're entering a free fire zone. And they backed that up by placing a bomb at the newly constructed airport in Cuba, placed bombs on the buses that took people from the airport to the hotels. They even positioned boats off the shore of Havana and fired cannon shot into the hotels. A bomb exploded in the Copacabana Hotel, killing an Italian tourist. Nightclubs were targeted and were bombed. Cuba protested each of these actions to the United States. without a response. It then brought a case at the Security Council claiming, and you've all heard this, but only recently, that any country that harbors terrorists is as guilty as the terrorists themselves. That item is still on the agenda of the Security Council and has never been acted upon. Finally, when there was no response, either from the U.S. or the international community, Cuba did the only thing available to it. It sent over a group of men, these five volunteers, and they infiltrated those groups in southern Florida. They had no weapons. They brought no explosives. They harmed no Americans. They did no arson. There was no sabotage. But they succeeded in infiltrating these groups. And they reported back to Cuba on the planned attacks that were coming. What Jane has already told you, part of the Cuban intelligence which has prevented major loss of life in Cuba. The FBI became aware of their activities and arrested the five. They were put on trial in the one city in the United States where they could not get a fair trial, in Miami, a city of several million, but the largest grouping in Miami is a Cuban-American exile community, 650,000 people. They also parenthetically control the electoral results in Florida, as we saw in 2000. The defendants asked for the case to be moved, that they could not get a fair trial. Dr. Lisando Perez, the outstanding expert on the Cuban-American community in the United States, a professor at Florida International University, looking at the community and the activities that had occurred in the community in the previous four decades, said the chances of the five getting a fair trial in Miami were, to use his words, zero. But the judge refused to move the case, even though the defense did not ask for a change from Miami to New York, or Miami to Atlanta, or even Miami to Orlando. They asked that the case be moved 25 miles away to Fort Lauderdale, where they felt they could get a fair trial. But the judge, whose husband is an elected attorney for the city of North Miami Beach, had no alternative because her husband would have been out of a job had she moved the case, and he would have to find a legitimate employment, denied the request. The case went to trial in Miami. Now, it became the longest trial in the United States at the time. The case lasted almost 7 months, and the prosecutors were a little concerned about the weakness of the case overall. The case went to trial. All these witnesses testified, 119 volumes of testimony, over 20,000 pages of materials, and the jury convicted all five of all charges without asking a single question, and three received life sentences. One, Gerardo Hernandez, had double life sentence. One got 19 years and one 15 years. We took an immediate appeal. I was not a trial lawyer. I came in on the appeal. And well, we went to argue this appeal before the notorious 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which sits in Atlanta, Georgia. And here I'm defending Antonio Guerrero, my client, one of the five. And the court magnanimously gave the five lawyers representing the five a total of 15 minutes to argue their case. I had 3 minutes. My client was doing life. And the longest trial at the time it occurred in Florida. I'm looking through 119 volumes of testimony, 20,000 pages, and I have 3 minutes to say my piece. You get more time than that in traffic court. But a very interesting thing happened in the argument. The court, upon hearing the 3 minutes, doubled my time. I got 6 minutes. And the lawyers who were with me, all from Miami, were astounded that the court had become so liberal. When we argued the Chicago 8 appeal, again in a federal court of appeals in Chicago, in 1971, my client faced 10 years. And the court, and a trial that was also 6 months long, granted us 2 days to argue. But given court reform, which is a way of cutting down time, making the system, quote, more efficient, they cut down the time for lawyers, too, to argue appeals. So we argued it. The court, the three judges, took 16 months to decide the case. And then they came down with a decision which was, again, unprecedented in the history of the United States. For the first time in our history, a court ruled that a federal judge had erred in refusing to change venue. And in a 93-page opinion, reversed all of the charges and ordered that they either be freed or retried in another venue. Well, we were very pleased, and we were getting ready for the new trial in another venue, which we felt very optimistic about. But then Alberto Gonzalez intervened, the Attorney General, and he ordered the Miami prosecutor to appeal it to the entire 11th Circuit. We were just before three judges who, incidentally, had a total of 80 years amongst them and judicial experience, quite a prestigious panel. And he ordered to appeal it, and we felt, well, the 11th Circuit is not going to take this appeal. It's an unprecedented decision. It's 93 pages long. It's unanimous. They took it. And they took it, and we argued it. And in 2006, the court reversed the original panel. The original panel, which, after analyzing what Miami is and what it would mean for these five to go to trial in Miami very carefully, concluded, and then the last page, this venue presented the perfect storm of prejudice and bias against the accused. A perfect storm of prejudice and bias. But we didn't think the 11th Circuit, on the same record, could say this wasn't a perfect storm of bias. This was a bright, sunny day of tolerance. And they got certainly a fair trial, but that's what they did. On the very same evidence, they found it to be an absolutely fair trial. It wasn't until after we argued in the 11th Circuit that I found out from my colleagues from Miami that not once in a quarter century had that court sitting en banc ever ruled for a person charged with a crime. Not once in 25 years. It's quite a record. So they assumed that we would almost automatically lose. I was a little more optimistic. But then they had to send part of it back for further hearings because the venue didn't include all of the issues. There were other issues. And we just argued those on August 20th of this year. And now we're waiting for a decision. So the case is still alive. We're waiting for a decision. There are over 200 committees worldwide in favor of the five. If any of you ever happen to go to Cuba, you will see billboards. You will see murals, you will see posters, you will see literature all on the five who are considered to be national heroes. And when President Bush addressed Cuba yesterday, as you've pointed out, Jane, the Cubans did respond to the president's address, which was rather peculiar. He called on the international community to now come together on the issue of Cuba. Well, they have come together. They came together last year when they had to vote whether or not the embargo was legal. And the international community voted 183 to 4. You rarely get that much togetherness in the international community. So the only one who was isolated.
The only time.
Yeah. So the vote is coming up, as Jane said again, next week. And it bears watching because I'm curious to see the media who will not report on the Cuban Five, the same media, let's see if they follow up President Bush's speech yesterday with a report next week on the vote in the UN. My bet is you will not find a line in any of the media that the U.S., for the 16th time, was outvoted by a huge majority on the question of the embargo or the blockade. The case is a symbol, as you've pointed out, of the inequity and the injustice in the foreign policy. And it's one of the few cases that I've ever been involved in, maybe the Pentagon Papers is the only other one, which is an injustice abroad compounded by an injustice at home in the trial.
That was Len Weinglass speaking at the Brecht Forum in New York City. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.